You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, July 26, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. That's right, it's Casual Friday. Joining us will be the great Cliff Schechter. Also on the program, ostensibly to give me movie recommendations for the weekend, another parent of a young child. So he should have a lot of recommendations. John Fugelsang, host of Current Viewpoint. Also on the program today, Eric Holder tells Russia, we will not torture nor seek the death penalty for Edward Snowden. Meanwhile, the Senate Appropriations Committee approves trade sanctions against any country that offers asylum to Snowden. And Nancy Pelosi's role in quashing the Amash Conyers Amendment. Also, the left flank begins to push hard on expanding Social Security. And meanwhile, the right wing has a nefarious new group of groundswell. It's like a hall of fame for right-wing morons who connect with each other and plot their nefarious messaging. Also, as we draw closer to 2014, the right wing continues to freak out about the Affordable Care Act and now is actively and obviously trying to sabotage its implementation. And the Bradley Manning case continues. The prosecutors haven't fully rested, but they gave their closing statements yesterday in the Bradley Manning case. Some pretty stunning quotes from that. Also, Halliburton pleads guilty to destroying evidence in the wake of the BP disaster in the Gulf. All that and more, ladies and gentlemen, but it's Casual Friday. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Cliff Schechter. Ladies and gentlemen, it is Casual Friday. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. And before we get to our guest, Cliff Schechter, we need to bring him in a proper manner.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services? You know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.
Cliffcentral.com. Hello, Cliff. How are you?
I'm doing well, Sammy. How are you?
I'm doing well as well. We will just a little housekeeping here. We'll be on vacation next week. We have mostly all new shows for folks, but that means that you will also get a much-deserved vacation next week.
I have been working hard for you.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it is the highlight of the week. It's either you or the theme song that people get very excited about.
And then there's those people that suffer through the theme song in their heads over the weekend and want to kill me.
That's right. The many people, they say that it's their top one in the shower song for 2012. That's not an official title, but...
I just hope Anthony Weiner doesn't listen to it in the shower.
Indeed. Well, let us know if you get any picks. So, all right, we had quite a week this week to recap. I want to just touch on the vote that took place. I believe it was now 2 days ago, Wednesday. The Amash Conyers amendment that
was. Yeah, Amash is like the new Ron Paul.
Indeed, but the difference in this instance is that
probably less racist.
Well, perhaps. I mean, I don't know Amash well, but the difference here, of course, is that a majority of Democrats voted with him, and a majority of Republicans voted against that amendment. And the latest story out in foreign policy details how Nancy Pelosi. And I think really through Steny Hoyer, whipped against this bill with so-called moderate or conservative Democrats. And then she subsequently, you know, reiterated she has in the past been fairly decent on these things to a certain extent, but certainly a mixed record. How are we to interpret this other than we know that there's basically a Democratic establishment, not unlike a Republican establishment in some respects, that really doesn't want to curtail these powers.
I don't think there's any other conclusion to come to. I mean, because Nancy Pelosi has to kind of balance that she's the leader of the congressional Democrats with the fact that she herself, has always been progressive and comes from a very progressive district. And most of the time when you find her, or at least in my experience, taking bad positions on issues, it's because she's gotten pressure from somewhere.
Right. Well, I think it was pretty clear early on, where the leadership was going to be on this when the White House came out earlier in the week and went on a full court press to quash this amendment. Now, with that said, I think, you know, The real story was that it was only a 12 vote. It lost by only 12 votes.
It was only 205 to 217 in the negative, which is pretty amazing. I don't think the people that were defending it thought it was going to come that close. But, you know, it is a big deal. I mean, it's a big deal that enough people in the security establishment as well as the Obama administration obviously pressured her to the point where she, you know, it reminds me of like when they pressured Democrats against – you know, when Obama ran on the reimportation of drugs, and then they pressured the Democratic Senate to defeat Byron Dorgan's amendment to reimport prescriptions from Canada. In that way, it's like when they go and they pressure our own leaders to just do what is really sort of not indefensible, I would say.
And the upshot is, of course, though, I think that, you know, in many respects, this vote was symbolic, and it puts the leadership and the White House on notice that future attempts to curb the power of this basically this surveillance regime are going to be sort of less blunt of an instrument are going to have a chance to pass. I mean, we have now, you know. Reform bills that are lining up, ranging from how the FISA court appoints its justices, their ability to make law, to adjudicate law, as opposed to just being issuing bench warrants, We have Wyden, who is going to offer bills that will curtail the mass surveillance. We have Rush Holt introducing bills. I mean, I think this is just the beginning of a long process, but that vote, I think, was indicative that I think there we're going to see at least some reform here. And I spoke to Glenn Greenwald earlier in the week, and he was he has been really impressed with how much impact these revelations have had in that regard. And frankly, I am, too. I think it's really it really seems like there was some pent up demand by, you know, a.
Well, especially once all this stuff came out, and, you know, there are people that defend it. Would defend all of it reflexively, and there, you know, I think if you take a look within some of it, it's obviously, as we've discussed a lot, heading down a dangerous path. And, you know, it's something that at the very least an argument can be made what you need to do, in a modern society with the kind of technology that's out there with terrorists and whatever. But at the same time, that there be some accountable oversight that exists, right, which we don't seem to have any of. And obviously, a lot of us thought the FISA courts are working, you know, and I'll put myself among those because I defended them when, of course, the Bush administration was trying to go around them. And I thought, well, this seems to be the perfect answer, you know, and it's not, because we found out that they pretty much rubber stamp almost any request that goes to them. And judges, obviously, when you think, you know, and I should have given it more thought that time, but obviously these judges are making decisions in secret without accountability. And who's picked as a judge is pretty important. As we pointed out before, Louis Goldberg was once a judge. So, I mean, what I've always said here is I don't know that I have all the answers. I think, it's difficult, but I certainly think wanting more accountability, more oversight is necessary. And so doing this, you know, and this has happened before. I wish I could remember the exact votes on other issues like Iraq and whatever, where, you know, the vote keeps getting closer and closer. And it does send a signal when you come, even if you fail, when you come that close. You know what I mean? It's a message.
Yes.
And that's important.
Yeah,
unlike,
I mean, it functions
say, the
in some respects.
Repealing Obamacare votes that never get any closer, but just have Republicans.
It functions in some respects as a threat. I mean, this is looming out there, and if you don't, if we don't have some reforms, then what's going to happen is it's going to be the program's going to be shut down completely. Now, Charlie Savage has a really interesting article out this morning. I don't know if you saw it, but. Apparently, Judge James Robertson, appointee of Bill Clinton, who was assigned to the surveillance court in 2002 by Rehnquist at the time, he resigned from it in December 2005, said essentially that during his time, this is 2002 to 2005, the court was not engaged in developing any body of secret precedents, interpreting what the law means. It wasn't until... he said, in my experience, there weren't any opinions. You approved a warrant application or you didn't, period. It was under Bush in 06 or so or 05 that the court started to issue these type of hearings. And then in 08, the FISA amendments allowed the courts to have a little bit more of authority in adjudicating and overseeing what the NSA was doing. And clearly that was a problem. And that's something that I think that definitively has to be reversed. And when you see votes like this, it gives me some optimism that that's going to happen, because there's a threat looming out there. You're 12 votes away from scrapping all of the authority. And
you had to have your leader whip just to make sure you only lost by 12 votes.
Indeed.
Like, yeah.
And so
I agree with you on that completely. I think that's going to these guys are probably a little bit scared right now, and then they're going to have to be more accountable to what we want. So that's good.
All right. Now let's turn to the speech that President Obama gave earlier in the week. It was hailed as an important economic speech, and it's gotten mixed reviews. I mean, frankly, the things that he's proposing there, they may be old, but they're still good ideas. It's just that they haven't been implemented. What is clear, though, from that speech, in my estimation, is that President Obama is now sort of making his bed or remaking his bed in some respects and is going to sees that there's only one way for him to have any type of decent legacy when it comes to the economy, and that is going to be head down the road where you're picking a fight with the Republicans in some way. I don't know if it's going to be effective. It could be too little too late, but it's somewhat encouraging, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is. A lot of us wish it had come at a much sooner point when he had majorities and it could have been more effective. But, yeah, I mean, I think maybe they get – somehow they've come to understand that the bully pulpit means something, that you can change opinion, the thing that Republicans have done, you know, forever. I mean, done it in always a dishonest way, but have used PR campaigns to turn people against things that they were for by speaking loudly and carrying a big stick, so to speak. You know, there maybe the Obama people get now that you need to make an argument, you know? I mean, the problem is from the beginning, a lot of this stuff has been made within the framework of what the right wants.
Yeah.
Which is anything you do has to be deficit neutral, and you always have to be cutting spending because spending, we're still admitting, is bad. I mean, some of that's changed, but instead of forcefully standing up and pointing out all the terrific programs that government has invested in over the years and reminding people that government spending is a necessary aspect of making some of these terrific results and terrific programs work and how society used to work when we did that, you know? So it's definitely better, but I'll give him credit for that. I do worry in terms of, you know, it is too little, too late. I mean, I guess with this crew at this point, I'm really not sure what you can do.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of it is just sort of, I guess, maybe just, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, there's going to be a big battle come September when it's budget time and when it's debt ceiling time. And it seems at least that we're going to see more of the what we saw the last debt ceiling fight, which I guess was now, about a year ago, I think. Less of what we saw than what, you know, from 2 years ago. In other words, we won't get a sequester. We're just going to get, we just don't believe that you guys are going to try and, renege on the country's commitment to pay off its bills. And,
right.
You know, it's, that is, this is going to take place, a year out from the 2014 elections. And I think, you know, it seems at least, and, you know, we can talk about the idea of floating Larry Summers as a Fed chair, because the Fed is really one of the few things, if we buy into the notion that there is gridlock, which I think is, you know, it's quite clear, the Fed is one of the few places where, you know, the lack of fiscal stimulus for the economy can be affected in any way. And,
right.
And so, you know, there's sort of a give with one hand, take away with the other, the idea of Larry Summers in some respects, and particularly when you're talking about regulation. We spoke to David Dayan about the Larry Summers on this point, but there's,
sure, he said nice things.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I mean,
you know, Larry Summers will come in. He'll hire a couple of broads to work under him. You know. See if they can understand the math.
Exactly. And Larry Summers, famous for saying, when he was president of Harvard, he sort of famously said that women just aren't very good with math. Is that what it was?
Yeah, we should guide them in other directions.
Yes.
You know, where they're more talented.
Yes.
Like cheerleading and stuff.
So hopefully the White House is getting the message that there's just no value in attempting to appoint Larry Summers. The other encouraging aspect on this front is what we're also seeing is a left flank here. I know you've done a lot of work with Social Security Works in the past, but we're seeing sort of a concerted effort now to push for expansion of Social Security.
That's right. Which I, you know, that I mean, I'm not working with them right now. I've worked with them in the past, and it's exciting to see them doing that. Instead of just sort of playing the defensive role, which, you know, we had to play when the Simpson-Bowles garbage was going on. But now, sort of sitting there and wow, what do you know? Suddenly there are surpluses and all the doom you guys predicted didn't happen. And Social Security is easily one of the best programs in the history of the world. So why don't we expand that program and give seniors more security and more buying power? It just kind of makes sense, doesn't it? So I'm really, you know, they're out there pushing it. I'm really happy they are.
And, you know, we should say, like, it's the PCCC, Democracy for America, Credo, Action, Move On, Social Security Works, Progressives United, Russ Feingold's outfit. And the other interesting thing about just that dynamic is there's a plan that and they're supporting of this plan that that Tom Harkin and Mark Begich from Alaska are proposing. And it's interesting to see Begich on this. I mean, Harkin,
I know.
But Begich, I mean, that's a good sign, isn't it? I mean, he's not necessarily the most obvious candidate to be pushing for expansion of Social Security.
No, he's not. I still have much hatred for him on the gun, what he did on guns, quite frankly. It doesn't mean I won't support his efforts here. You know, he's in the past been a little bit of a finger in the wind, the guy. So it tells me if he thinks that this is a winning issue, which I don't seem to understand why most of the rest of these guys don't get that this is the sort of perfect populist issue, particularly with a group of voters, if you want to look at it from a political angle, older white voters that Democrats have been losing. This is the issue where you can win them. And in states where there's lots of those old white voters, like let's say if you're running for tough re-elections in Arkansas and your name is Mark Pryor, or you know, Louisiana and your name is Mary Landrieu. These might be smart things to embrace. So, I mean, it is a good sign. It's a good sign that the sort of new Democrat kind of thinking isn't controlling on this issue, which is nice.
Yeah, so, and it is. I mean, he is one of those, you know, fingers in the wind. And so it gives, you know, it's encouraging that that's the way the wind, he perceives that's the way the wind is blowing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we spend a lot of time analyzing where you know, where we get, you know, the right has a lot more money and we get outgunned and we're, you know, we have, there's so many fights we have to fight. But I think a lot of people involved in this particular fight should be pretty proud that in a year's time we've gone from defending, this program from being cut, first in a real structural way, second through the stealth chain CPI, which would have hurt a lot of people. And now we're in a place where we're talking about expanding it. Pretty good turn of events, if you ask me, and a lot of groups, and you named some of them, and there's other ones in addition to those, who've been out there fighting and making sure that the truth gets out, honest messages get out, instead of all this sort of doom and gloom, we're falling over a fiscal cliff and the earth will come to an end kind of crap, that, you know, it's just rehashed Ross Perot stuff.
Now, that takes us to now we're going to sort of get a little more fun with today's roundup. There's a big story. Well, I don't know if it's a big story, but it's there's a really fun story that David Corn over at Mother Jones, and I don't know how it is that these guys keep getting this stuff, but
you got to give Corn credit.
Yes.
At some point, he's done a pretty good job where these guys, people trust him and are giving him some amazing scoops. So you were going to tell the story, so I'll let you tell it. And I'll try to laugh too hard while
I
you
don't
are.
Know if people remember the whole journalist brouhaha. This was – the journalist was an email list of basically – some like lefty journalist and some sort of center left journalist, I would say. And
yeah.
Full disclosure, I was on that list for a period of time. And
communist.
Sort of what was that?
Communist.
And you know,
it's a little fun with you, Sammy. We're going on vacation next week. I get my jabs in now.
Indeed. And when apparently somebody leaked. And we say leaked. I mean, these are private email lists, just like, you know, I have one. I'm also on one, full disclosure, for parents of people at my public school, you know, that parents go back and forth with stuff. And
Was it parents of people what?
Well, no, the school that my daughter goes to, the parents have a list as well, an email list.
Do you guys have some exciting conversations on that list?
You know, mostly about nannies. I think
kid peed his pants today. What the hell's going on?
Exactly. Kind of why isn't there?
We're on those lists too. I'm just kidding with you.
Right. Of course. And so, but when this was leaked, I think it was to the Daily Caller, and then Breitbart.
Wait, Tucker Carlson, the big scoop.
Yes.
Tucker Swanson, McNeil Carlson, the 14th.
They ran for that.
Just live off of the Swanson food fortune that he's, you know, his trust fund has to torture us by showing up and saying ever more stupid things every day.
Wait a second. Is he really that big of a trust fund baby?
Oh, yeah. He comes from the Swanson food, frozen food family.
Well,
yes.
Why did he become so desperate? I was sort of, you know, this is a guy who sort of lamented how horrible the right-wing media had become and then went on to found essentially one of the most horrible
the
right-wing
lowest
media.
trolling scummiest outfit in the Daily Caller. He just is an attention whore. It's not about money. You know, he just needs people to be looking at him. And once you get fired from all of your TV shows because nobody actually likes you and you have nothing interesting to say, I guess you got to find another way to get people to pay attention. So that's the Daily Caller.
I guess so. And they spent months on this. And Breitbart, the late Andrew Breitbart, offered, I think, $100,000 for the complete archives of this. And it was like, I think you can still listen to right-wing radio and hear them reference it. This was the biggest blockbuster story that that in some way these journalists were talking to each other. And it was, you know, the stuff ranged from like political commentary to what's the best restaurant in Chicago?
Well, here's the key thing about the journalist thing. And I wasn't on it because I'm not nearly as cool as you.
Well,
but the thing about it is, first of all, as far as I know, and I knew a lot of people on it, it was actually all journalists. It wasn't a mixture of journalists and advocates and
you
know, congressional members and people plotting together, which theoretically, and we're going to get to what you're talking about with David Corn and this groundswell group, which kind of takes away the definition of being a journalist if you're doing that. And so it was all journalists who were just trading ideas or whatever. They were mostly was innocuous stuff like that. You know, it came out that Dave Weigel had said that, at some point was pissed at Rush Limbaugh for insulting him on the air and said he should do the world a favor and set himself on fire, which I kind of actually agree with. I think it's one of the better things Dave Weigel said. But the Washington Post feels differently than me, and once that came out, they fired him from his job.
Yeah.
So at the Post. And so that was kind of one of the big sort of fallout from the whole thing.
Yes, now Weigel went on to his career. It didn't really seem to interrupt his career at all. He ended up getting a bunch of job offers after that. But
he's at Slate now and seems to be doing okay.
Yes.
So it's just the fact that that was kind of all that came out of that. In the end, it was sort of the right wing and their vast liberal conspiracy and all that sort of stuff. And it was just a bunch of journalists talking to each other on a list, sharing tips and ideas. And I mean, I'm not really sure how that, you know, I guess there could be something untoward about it if they were all sort of coordinating stories and saying, let's get the message out together. Kind of like what was happening in Groundswell.
Right. Well, the Alex Perrine had a great piece on Groundswell, and that was that there's a reason why the right wing, sort of sees something nefarious like that, like the Obama administration feeding stuff to journalists or whatever it was, and it's because they do it. And so it's one of those classic, cases of
well, right-wing projection. It's like, yeah. You know, when you hear them saying they're liberals or evil, they just operate out of hate. You're sitting there like, you guys really, man, you got that projection thing down. Almost everything they say about you, you can usually assume they're saying it because they assume that you're going to do the things that they actually do.
And then the irony is, too, that Perrine makes a good point at the end of his piece as he says that, the reality is this is not, conspiracy between the establishment and the base, because the establishment is the base. It says there's very little difference between, I think, Senator Mike Lee and a diarist at redstate.com short of occupation. And that is the reality, is that, but the funny part about Groundswell is just sort of, is some of the exchanges. groundswell apparently includes one of the influential, I'm reading from the David Corn piece, one of the influential conservatives guiding the group is Virginia Ginny Thomas. This is Clarence Thomas's wife. She, of course, has had multiple jobs, I think, at the Heritage Foundation, at Hillsdale College, all part of the right wing.
But she didn't get any of them because of who her husband is.
That, I'm sure, is a tremendous coincidence. But also on the group is John Bolton, Frank Gaffney.
he's the guy that when people are talking and won't shut up, he throws his shoes at them.
That's right. Frank Gaffney, the guy who sees, you know, Muslim conspiracy everywhere as well. Tom Filton, the president of Judicial Watch.
The well-known temperamentally in control Alan West.
Yes, and Ken Blackwell and Jerry Boykin. Is Boykin the former general?
Yes, he's the one that like basically got ran out because he was going around telling people that they were fighting for the sword of Jesus to defeat the infidels and said shit like that to people before we went to fight.
We will note that indeed.
Which is what you want in your military. And you definitely want that.
A bunch of former House members and the top aide to Ted Cruz. And so it really is sort of like it sort of has the feeling like I immediately conjure up sort of this like warped parallel universe. It's a small world, like with all these animatrons of the biggest morons on the right wing just sort of bobbing their heads back and forth. But some of the quotes from this are great.
It's basically your single A conservative League of Justice.
Yes.
And they all probably have costumes they come up dressed up in. I mean, you've seen the only picture I've ever seen of Ginny Thomas is wearing that stupid thing on her head, like she's the Statue of Liberty at a tea party. You see that picture?
Oh,
like
yes. Really,
that may be the only picture of her that exists. So every time I see a picture of her, she looks like an idiot.
And I love the way that these guys refer to this. I mean, like there was a message circulated. They have a Google group. And which is, you know, just a mechanism to do an email list. And it circulated to members and noted the role of certain advocates should be kept off the Google group for OPSEC reasons. OPSEC, of course, meaning operational security.
I mean, did anybody name themselves 007?
That's right.
On the list?
We've got to keep some of the names off the list for OPSEC purposes.
You know what I picture when you play that? Not really the mission of Mission Impossible as much as like John Belushi running back and forth and falling on his ass.
That's right. Serpentine. That's kind of,
from Animal House, of course. That's what we're talking about here. But you know, you left out really the best part. I mean, of course, you have all these leading geniuses of the right, all celebrated and known for their brilliance. But on top of that, the journalists who are actually there, who are coordinating with them, I won't count Breitbart in that because I don't really think anybody thinks that Breitbart.com is anything but propaganda. Maybe
right.
I'm wrong, and there may be two people out there who think that it's an actual journalistic endeavor. I mean, I guess it still is embarrassing for them because they try to pretend that they do some sort of journalism or something. I don't know. But, you know, there were people from the Washington Examiner and the National Review. And whatever you think of those publications, and I don't think a huge amount of them, but they are actually considered to be independent, you know, publications, you know, enemy periodicals. And they were there. There are people who were there coordinating with this group of imbeciles.
Yeah,
so just know that anytime you read the National Review and the Washington Examiner.
Yes, of course. I mean, that was just so obvious. I mean, that, none of that is in any way to me surprising, or, you know, I don't even find it offensive at this point.
I find it funny, actually.
But here's where it starts getting good, is actually what they're talking about. And they're going on. At one point, they said in February 28th at a groundswell gathering. They said, I love this music in the background. We're failing the propaganda battle with minorities. Terms like GOP, Tea Party, conservative communicate racism. So they proposed an alternative. Frederick Douglass Republican. They wanted to.
And what was the best part about calling themselves Frederick Douglass Republican?
They misspelled Douglass.
They misspelled Frederick Douglass. Both names.
That is just awesome. And.
Just like your basic tea partier that holds up a sign, you know, and literally has four words in the sentence and can't spell all of them correctly, these geniuses can't literally take the time to figure out how to spell Frederick Douglass.
And
fantastic.
Well, they also, what's also awesome about this group is just how out of touch they are. And it's also, you know, people wonder how it is, like when we were talking about, well, I mean, let me read what they say, and it'll give you a notion of just what is driving the Republican Party here. Conservatives are so busy. This is notes from a March 20th meeting. Conservatives are so busy dealing with issues like immigration, gay marriage, and Boy Scouts. There is little time left to focus on other issues. These are the very issues the left wants to avoid, but we need to magnify, right? Now, okay, so they've cracked the code.
Could that be Benghazi, Benghazi, Benghazi?
I'm telling you, it goes on. Republicans cannot beat Obama at their own game, but need to go on the offensive and define the issues. The proposed offensive would include hyping Fast and Furious and slamming Obama's record and touting Benghazi as a full-fledged scandal. The problem is Speaker Boehner and Representative Mike Rogers are refusing to deal with the Benghazi issue. Leaders can be and should be shamed into doing the right thing. I mean, I don't even know what to say about this.
I would say it's great literature, is what I would say. It's sort of, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Yeah. You're not dealing with Benghazi.
You're not dealing with Benghazi. At one point, they're coming up with, they're trying to figure out how they can deal with this immigration bill. And Kelly Carrender, the national grassroots coordinator of Tea Party Patriots, posted a message to the Google group writing, "We should have a unified name for the immigration bill. So that the other side is calling it reform, we present a unified front against that notion. If we're calling it different things, their reform message will win. We only combat the idea that is the reform if we hammer back with one different phrase name." She tossed out a few suggestions. One, the Schumer-Rubio bill, because Schumer, of course, is from New York and is a hated figure on the right.
And a Jew.
Right. You know, anti-security bill. Amnesty bill. And then Cheryl Kaufman, the communications director for Representative Jim Bridestone, chimed in that she was fond of a phrase derived by Moncrief. I don't know who Moncrief is. Are you ready?
And I love this phrase. You're
all
about to
caps.
Say. Everybody prepare.
Obamagration. I love it. Communicates the similarity with Obamacare. Sadly, it does not seem to have caught on in the right wing.
I would
circles.
Have called it, if I were, you know, like them, maybe the tacos with a side of salsa bill. I think maybe that, you know, you can get your racism in there. You know, I don't know. These people are just awesome.
I right now am going to offer. I'm going to offer $100,000 if this group decides to make all of their discussions public and do it in real time with audio so that we could actually play some of this stuff. I don't think there's anything nefarious about what they're doing. I want to encourage them to continue to do it. I just want them to make it publicly accessible so that we can actually monetize this on the podcast in some fashion.
That would be fantastic. I want to hear what Ginny and Bolton can come up with together.
Absolutely stunning. The just sort of the level of Obamagration, I love it!
Obamagration coming to the nation.
Let's do this. And for OPSEC,
like...
for OPSEC reasons, of course, we need to all just pretend like we're one or two syllables off from Obamagration when we introduce this so that we can show in public that we're coalescing around it. So someone is going to say Barackagration. Someone else will say Obama immigration. Someone else will say Obama amnesty or something like that. And then we can all coalesce around Obamagration. And then we follow the proper OPSEC protocols to do this. You
excellent.
All have
and
your marching
also remember,
orders.
It's always about politics over public safety.
There you go. And everybody goes out to...
That was their big phrase with Benghazi. which like 8 of them repeated in headlines of columns and pieces they wrote and stuff like that. These things they said on TV, politics over public safety.
And now, lastly, we had talked about this story, I think it was yesterday, on the Better Half, but it really got your goat, and very well should, was this story coming out of, I think it was Ohio.
Yes, it is.
Why don't you tell the stories? This is your hometown, your home state.
Well, this nice young lady goes out of town. Let's get her name right. I want to make sure.
Katie Barnett.
Okay, thank you. Katie Barnett, who's from Vinton County. She's out of town. She comes back and finds that basically all of her stuff is missing. And it turns out the First National Bank of Wellston had arrived at her place, broke in, took all of her belongings, including her house, because they had the wrong person whose house they were supposed to repossess. But to me, the best part of it, what these assholes did, is they sold off her stuff worth about $18,000. And now, and to me, this is just a metaphor for our times,
yeah,
is that they've refused to give her back money, and she said that when she's called, these people have basically been sarcastic with her and laughed at her about it. I mean, these evil, evil, evil people who have basically, who've just destroyed this, at least not destroyed her life, but stolen. I mean,
right.
This is, I mean, if I did what they did, I would be in prison right now, and rightfully so. Somehow, they're not giving her anything back. And I don't get how, under the laws I was brought up to believe in, they don't have to do that.
Now, someone suggested to me yesterday that there was no mens rea, I guess, which is a criminal intent. But and it may be the case that they accidentally broke into the house, fine. But the police chief is refusing to investigate, has considered the case closed, but she still doesn't have her stuff back.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I mean, there may be mens rea. Okay, so but we're not trying to, in the end, if they weren't doing it on purpose, it wasn't a criminal act, then fine, we won't charge them criminally. Give her freaking stuff back. It's not yours.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, if I don't know if somebody's sitting somewhere and I put and I happen to pick up their gold watch by mistake because I think it's mine. In the end, I maybe didn't have a criminal mind. It still does actually belong to them, and I still should give it back when I know that I incorrectly took it. They now know.
Hold
that
on,
they did
breaking
something.
Story. Cliff Schechter has a gold watch.
I don't have a gold watch, so don't fall for that. I don't even have a watch at all.
There you go.
The kids chew on it.
Yeah, it's
not
a stunning story, but it really is the metaphor for our times, isn't it? I mean,
well,
just
isn't sort of, it like, I mean, what corporations can get away with versus individuals? I just tie it into the, you know, what we've looked at what's going on with Detroit, but I know you probably have a great conversation with a good friend of mine coming up, my old advisor, coming up next week. Who wrote a great book on Detroit, how we can find billions and billions and trillions for banks, but we can't find $18 billion for Detroit.
Right.
I mean, so to me, the Ohio thing speaks to that and everything else, where our priorities are, what kind of sort of people we've become, you know, which is just sort of whistling past the graveyard. These guys are laughing at her, and they're being sarcastic with her when she's calling because they stole her stuff.
I mean, I hope that there's just a huge sort of media outcry against this, and that bank just ends up becoming a pariah.
Well, there's a petition one of our friends sent out on Twitter, and I retweeted it, from our friend Suspended Account,
uh-huh,
which I like the name of that account. I retweeted it a little while ago, and it's at Daily Costs, and I will retweet it again. But you should go there and sign this, because it's a petition to sort of say you'd better prosecute and get this woman's stuff back.
All right. Well, we'll post it on majority.fm. Cliff, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much. And I will talk to you in 2 weeks, buddy.
All right, man. Have a great vacation.
All
don't
right,
pick
thanks.
Too many strawberries or whatever you do up there.
Yeah. No, it's not the strawberry season now, but I appreciate it.
All right, dude.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to current TVs and star of the Sexy Liberal Tour, John Fugelsang.
You
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is my big, huge pleasure and honor to welcome to the show, long overdue to this program, the host of Current TV's Viewpoint, the star of the, or one of the stars, I should say, to be fair, of the Sexy Liberal Tour, John Fugelsang. John, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being here.
Sam, what a pleasure. I'm such a fan of what you do, and I've been a fan for such a long time, and it's really an honor to drag your show down to my level. Thank you.
Well, we just had Cliff Schechter on, so it's going to be... So you've been doing Viewpoint since basically the time that Al Jazeera America is coming in. The run is coming to an end, as they say. And I got to say, I mean, it's been harder for me to watch because it hasn't been on in New York. But and I've done your show a couple of times. It's I think it is. It is an incredibly unique show because I think that you're one of the best sort of comedians out there who really does genuine comedy about politics, but with a very specific political agenda. I mean, with a genuine ideology behind it. And it's,
well, thank you.
I think it really didn't get the attention it deserved, because what you guys ended up doing over there was really sort of fascinating, and you sort of dropped into a situation and really made that show your own. And
well, thank you. Yeah, I think Ariel Castro is going to get more wedding proposals in prison than we have viewers on some days. But we actually brought the ratings up about a year ago. Al Gore and the folks at Current offered me to come over and do a political comedy talk show here for the network. I had sort of gotten some notoriety on CNN doing Soledad O'Brien show every morning when I caused this. I asked this question that led to this Etch-a-Sketch kerfuffle.
Oh, right.
And our was doing the Stephanie Miller Sexy Liberal Tour, and our album had gone to number one, and Current had filmed us for a documentary on the tour, and so they offered me to come over, and I thought that'd be great. I'd love to come and do a political comedy talk show that would be able to go from funny to serious on a dime, and try it out. And then I came in, and suddenly I was being sent around the country filling in for everybody else, from Bill Press to Joy Behar, and it became obvious they were going to sell the network. So my show never happened, and instead they asked.
Now wait, now I saw one episode though, right? I mean, it was so that happened. Right?
We had a week in review show while we were waiting for my show to launch.
Okay,
they said we want to do a week in review show. So for 5 weeks, we did this show with Joy Behar's staff around election time, and it was just a comedic take on stuff during the week. And we had great guests. We had Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols, and we had Ed Asner. It was a lot of fun. But then when the new year came, I think it was July 2nd, I just hosted Joy Behar's show, and I got the word that Al Jazeera had bought Current for Al Jazeera America. So they asked me to take over the 8 p.m. show, which had been Elliot Spitzer's, and before that, Keith Olbermann's. And I love the staff on that show. I thought they had put together two very distinct, very great programs. And we began trying to take the show and turn it into a sort of an irreverent, intelligent hybrid, and have, yep, congressmen and journalists and various electeds and academics and activists for the first half, and then bring on political comedians or pundits for the second half. I know so many great political comics in New York and L.A., and it's really impossible for smart political comedians to get on TV and do their stuff. There's no venue where you can do political stand-up. Dave and Jay, God bless them, they do political jokes. They don't ever book – they rarely book political people on. I think Conan had Jamie Kilsey on once. Mm. So, it was a great chance for me to invite some of the smartest, most clever people I know and mix them up. And it's the same level to invite conservatives on and try to get something that was more like sports talk, where you could have people disagreeing passionately but still getting along. And so it's been a real fun ride, and it's been great having you be a part of it, Sam. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. I mean, there's guys that bring it, and then there's you. I would put you up for any topic at all, but your audience already knows that. So it's been a fun adventure, and we have 3 more weeks to go, and we're looking forward to having all kinds of surprises.
Yeah, now, folks can, even if it's not carried, my understanding is that there are there are these websites that stream this stuff. That's my understanding, but I don't want any CISPA police or whatever it is to come knocking down our door here. So let's just leave it at that. But I hope that a new venue pops up for you, because it really
I'm doing it. I'm going to be doing a documentary this fall for PBS on Alexis de Tocqueville, retracing the path he journeyed when he wrote Democracy in America, and going to all the plantations and prisons, and really exploring the concept of the American dream as Tocqueville defined it, and how it's played out 180 years later. So I'm also writing a book and doing a lot of stand-up, so I'll be on the road.
Wow, are you serious about that documentary? That sounds awesome.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. It's going to be like 5 weeks shooting all over America and really retracing the steps. Because when de Tocqueville first came to America, he was sent by the French government to do a report on conditions in American prisons. And that was his reason for coming here, and that was his funding. But along the way, he wound up writing extensively about religion, about commerce, about the plight of blacks, the plight of Indians, and what life was like in the country. And he's one of the few figures that liberals, conservatives, and libertarians all claim as one of their own. I think really only sociologists can claim him as one of their own. And, you know, these filmmakers approached me wanting to do a film about how the concept of the American dream has kind of played out over almost 200 years. So it should be really, really fun, and I'm looking forward to, you know, doing that. But I'll still be doing other stuff. I'm on this weekend. I appear on both the Wendy Williams Show and the Ed Schultz Show. So something for each hemisphere of the human brain.
Yes, that I got to say that documentary is just, I think it's just a brilliant idea. That sounds great.
Like you, I have a baby, so I'll look for any excuse to be away for weeks at a time.
Indeed. Well, yeah. I mean, we will get to your film recommendation, because I don't know how you're allowed to leave for that long a time. I'm not allowed to go out for more than 2 hours at a time, frankly, if I'm not doing this show.
I spent most of the first year of my son's life on the road doing the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour, and you know, it really, I mean, babies are horrible people. You know this. They're awful people. And babies are abusive, and they will beat you and smack you and manipulate you. And we think that's love. Babies are Chris Brown, really, and we are all Rihanna. It's great. And, you know, I'm kind of learning you do the work. You do the work now so you can have time with them later.
Yeah, exactly. And all right. Now, so before we get to the film, I got what has captured your attention in the news this week? It's been a crazy news week in many respects, some of which has just been overshadowed by Wiener in some way. And give me your
sense.
Yes,
it's been amazing. I mean, you know, it's been Wienerama here in New York City. I mean, if y'all around the country are sick of it, imagine what it's like for us here. Which is fun to some degree. I mean, you know, the weather here was so disgusting last week. Huma Abedin was defending it. But it's amazing to me. First off, I respect that it's a ratings-driven media.
Right.
And in ratings-driven media, you know, you got to go for the eyeballs, and that's just the commercial reality. And yet, to see a guy who had the first sex scandal with no sex, who is probably never going to have sex again, is not having any sex right now, and the media keeps demanding he pull out. That's really the level we're dealing with now in American news. And what we tried to do on my show last night, we had Juan Cole on to discuss his piece on Anthony Weiner's record. Because a lot of people, you know, don't really mind that Carlos Danger enthusiastically supported the Iraq War. They're just angry about the sex thing. And for, you know, Palestinians and Palestinian Americans, they already know about Anthony Weiner's record on Palestine and how really defiant of logic he's been. The guy, he was in Congress 12 years, passed one bill, and really the most telling thing about him, I've learned from all the congressmen we have on our show, nobody wants him. No Democratic congressman has endorsed him, and they're all big Christine Quinn fans. So it's kind of sad, and I do think it's a legitimate story. I do think that for women, any woman with a computer knows what creepy male online behavior is like. And it's, you know, New Yorkers will forgive a sinner, but they will not forgive a serial lying BS artist.
I mean, you know, I, for to a large extent, I've largely avoided it just because Well, one, there's some major pathology there that I find problematic, but I also just never particularly liked, saw him as a guy who was going to do much other than preen. And, you know, there's definitely value for that, in the house.
A lot of people forget Anthony Weiner was the loudest defender and proponent of single payer health care in the Congress for a long time. And progressives learned to love him because he was on MSNBC every night being an attack dog. And Pelosi may not like the guy, but I have no doubt he raised a lot of money for the party.
Yeah, and also I think he did a good job at least carrying that message. There's certainly value in there, but he doesn't strike me as a guy I want running the city. But for that matter, I'm not a big fan of Christine Quinn's. But
I think the best thing we can say, he's certainly helping Elliot Spitzer this week, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
He's making Elliot look fantastic.
Indeed. But I'm not even clear, frankly. I don't know, maybe there's this has been a ratings boon, but last night, like, Chris Matthews is now going on bringing in multiple psychiatrists onto the show to break down. We've sort of gone through the looking glass on this stuff. It's just sort of.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. And again, this is exactly what we went through with Bill Clinton as well. And, celebrities have groupies and athletes have groupies and political figures have groupies. That's a reality, but how you handle that is very different when you're a politician, when you're running for votes in the public trust. I do think it's all legitimate news. I really do, and it's about society as well. I mean, for all that Anthony Weiner's done, he hasn't done anything that's been directly, deliberately malicious or hostile to his wife. It's been selfish, it's been thoughtless, it's been hurtful. He hasn't actually tried to be malicious to his wife, whereas the American media really has, much in the way they were hostile to Hillary Clinton. And what I don't get is Huma Abedin, whatever you think of her, has done everything society tells women they're supposed to do. She stayed with her husband for better or for worse. She honored her wedding vows when he didn't. And she said in the press conference this week that she's sticking around in this marriage for herself, for her child, and for her family. It's really hard for me to understand how progressives or conservatives can, crap all over her for that. I do think, if, like Mrs. Clinton, she harbors political ambitions, the irony is she's now been compared to Mrs. Clinton and likened to Mrs. Clinton so much that if she ever decides to run for office, the only way she could really do it would be if she divorced him and just created a whole new paradigm. And the wild card is maybe she just really loves the guy and wants to work it out.
Yeah, my feeling is whatever's going on in their marriage is their business. For me, the issue is just that the guy is so facile in lying about stuff that, I find him creepy. And just even beyond that, I just don't think that he has anything redeeming to offer as mayor. But yeah, I'm with you on this whole, the issue of his wife. I mean, in their marriage, that's for them. I mean, I don't know. I find the whole thing sort of.
If he became mayor, the Republican Party would use him to bludgeon the Democratic Party in a way that Democrats have not bludgeoned the Republicans for hanging on to David Vitter. I mean, the irony with this guy is if he had tortured someone, if he had taken a diaper fetish to the D.C. madam, or if he had lied to his family and his constituents and used taxpayer funds to illegally see his girlfriend in another country, the GOP would be forced to defend him.
Yeah.
So it's just, it boggles the mind. But it does give one the impression that when it comes to sex scandals, the Democrats have a higher standard.
Yeah. Well, all right. So let's move on to the scandal of my not being able to go out and see a movie that is in the theaters. What do you got that's a recommendation I can stream online? I got Roku. I got Amazon streaming. I got Apple TV.
If you haven't started Breaking Bad yet, if you haven't gotten into Breaking Bad yet, and to all your listeners, I'm very happy for you because you have the greatest TV adventure ahead of you. And the final season begins on August 11th, so you got about 3 or 4 weeks to catch up. It's just the best scripted show on TV. But you got to go out to the theaters this weekend, Sam, because everyone who cares about decent cinema or America needs to go see Fruitvale Station.
Yeah.
Directed by Ryan Coogler, who we had on the show last week. It's the story of Oscar Grant, who was shot unarmed by the transit cops, the BART transit cops, in the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area. I was up there at Occupy Oakland and Occupy San Francisco not long after, and he was already becoming a folklore figure. And this film really, aside from just being a great, you know, document of his last day, and it's based on, you know, where he went and his text messages he sent and the phone calls he made, his text messages of his final day of life are all in the film. It's really beautifully constructed. But even if it hadn't been a real film, a real story, it'd be an essential film about how hard it is for young black men in America. This character, who knows how much like the real Oscar Grant he is, it just breaks your heart. He's so trying to be a good guy, trying to get it together. He keeps screwing up, and the women in his life, his mother and his girlfriend, keep supporting him. And he keeps trying and trying so hard, and it's a tragic story that's beautifully made. Octavia Spencer, I think it's her first big role since she won the Oscar, and I can't recommend Fruitvale Station highly enough. It's just an amazing piece of filmmaking, and watching it, I couldn't believe an American had done it. So get out of the house to see that movie this weekend.
All right. Well, I mean, I'm going on vacation for the week. Maybe I will get some type of 2-hour reprieve. All right. Well, that's a great suggestion. Thank you, John. And thanks for coming
sure.
on. I really appreciate the time today. And I know, you know, you're running around from show to show today.
Yes, it's been kind of a silly one. I had Steph Miller and the Wendy Williams show, and now I'm at the current offices. But, you know, I'm such a fan of what you do. And for someone like me, I mean, my whole niche over here, I really talk a lot about religion and Christianity. My parents are both ex-clergy, and, you know, I spend most of my time getting in trouble for taking on the Christian right and using the Bible against the Christian right. And, you know, it's amazing when there are media outlets where you can come on and talk about the stuff that matters. And So that's why I came to Current, and that's why I watch your show. And I really want to thank you, Sam, for coming on my show so many times, but I also want to thank you for all you do for broadcasting and for democracy. Your show makes me proud to be an American all the time.
Wow. Well, I appreciate it, John. Thanks very much. All right, folks. We'll talk to you soon, John.
Fantastic. What a love fest. Take care.
All right. So we've got to take a break and head into the better half of the program, as I remind Matt. So, folks, just a little housekeeping. Next week we'll be on vacation, although Matt and Mike will be here on Monday, but not the following Monday. We have, I think, just about every day has all new interviews for next week, that most of which I did at Netroots Nation on Tuesday. We'll be talking to Tom Segrou, an interview I did with him this week about Detroit. Cliff mentioned briefly. And we will be back live on Monday, and then after that, a week from Monday, or I should say a week from Tuesday. So if you're sticking around for the better half, 646-257-3920. 646-
Again, live on Monday.
Yes, live on Monday. I just said that.
Just getting it in there.
646-257-3920 is the number. Folks, it's a great time to become a Majority Report member. You can do so at majority.fm.
What? Jimmy Reefer Cake song.
Oh, gosh! Jimmy Reefer Cake song. Jimmy Reefer Cake got us a song this week.
It's called Carlos Danger.
Carlos Danger.
I called myself Carlos Danger. On the internet, I'm hunting for strangers. I hope that I can earn your vote. I'm going to shove it down your throat. I'm skinny, but don't be fooled by my slight build. When I pull down my trousers, a thick monster is revealed. I want to be the mayor of NYC, and yet my private parts need to be seen. I hope that I can earn your vote. I'm wearing nothing under this coat. I'm skinny, but my junk is very large. I'm gonna rule this city, man, and my penis will be in charge. Carlos Danger! Carlos Danger!
Bravo, bravo.
That was good.
That was good.
That was funny.
That made the whole Wiener scandal and week of worth it. That was right in Jimmy Reefercake's wheelhouse. My favorite part was, and I really want to earn your vote. All right, folks. See you on the flip side. 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Become a member today at majority.fm. You can buy Amazon junk through our link, justcoffee.coop, coupon code majority. We're live on Monday, and then the following Tuesday. All right, talk to you then.